well. Good evening. Welcome once again to One Step Beyond. We are now going to proceed with the update that I did in December of 1989 of the December Surprise, the broadcast originally done in January of 1989. Now, bear in mind the central points of the original broadcast, and again, that was done on January 8th and 15th of 1989, and listen to this particular broadcast, which was done in December of 1989, a good 10 months or so later. We're now going to come back to elements of the Pan Am 103 Insurance Investigators Report, and we're going to go into recent information, which talks about a DEA link, which in many ways appears to intersect with the account of Pan Am 103, which is described in the Pan Am 103 Insurance Investigators Report. Now, again, if the Toronto Star article, which I read, was not entirely clear, that article was by way of summing up the whole Insurance Investigators Report. Most of the rest of the broadcast will in many ways be in apposition to or in exposition of that particular article. Those of you who are in a position to do so, we're going to go for about, 35 or 40 minutes, and we're going to hear the information already presented, and after this broadcast, I'm briefly going to mention where you can actually obtain these particular pages of the Pan Am 103 Insurance Investigators Report, the pages which are read into the record this particular time. We're going to go for about 35 minutes or so, and then we're going to come back, and we're actually going to go into that section of the Pan Am 103 Insurance Investigators Report, which describes, it was quoted briefly in the Toronto Star article from 11-13-89, which describes how the so-called CIA-1 team, which was running Manzar El-Kassar, was involved, at least according to that report, with the Iranian arms sales and also the Contra arms transfer as well. Manzar El-Kassar, again, a key player in the Iran-Contra scandal with Oliver North, surprisingly enough, an example of strange bedfellows, if ever there were. And then we're going to go into the Jafar connection, a fellow named Khalid Jafar, supposedly an individual involved in a DEA sting. That DEA operation, according to two broadcast reports that we will be looking at, called alternately Operation Courier or Operation Korea. Now, Korea is mentioned in the Pan Am 103 Insurance Investigators Report that you're going to be hearing here as the code name that CIA Control used for CIA-1. That was the code name for CIA-1 at CIA headquarters. Recall, and we will come back to this, that there was an attempt, supposedly one which was not successful, but an attempt to utilize the DEA to help effect the location of U.S. hostages in Lebanon, those supposedly being held by groups sympathetic to Iran. So we're going to go for between 30 and 35 minutes now, and then I'm going to come back and we're going to do the live section of tonight's broadcast, a long installment, some old, some new, and we will go into the hard details concerning the Pan Am 103 Insurance Investigators Report description of the CIA-1 Manzar El-Kassar involvement in the Iran-Contra scandal. So as to the, bear in mind again the chronology here, the information you're about to hear is in many ways corroborative of my December surprise hypothesis. It came out a good 9 months afterward. Those of you who are taping, please get ready to do so. 3, 2, 1, here we go. Basically is yet another supplement to the December Surprise Update broadcast. Now, in a nutshell, in my December Surprise, I analyze a number of events in and around the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. The principal feature of the December Surprise was that the bombing of that flight, which mentioned people who operated in connection with Manzar El-Kassar, namely a fellow named Abu Nidal and Abu Abbas, both of whom have dealt with Manzar El-Kassar, and in one way or another, Manzar El-Kassar being the weapons dealer tabbed by Oliver North for the Iria deal. Well, Oliver North's defense team and Lawrence Walsh were requesting documents on the Iria deal, and the Reagan administration refused to release those documents. The ultimate failure to obtain those documents was one of the main reasons that conspiracy charges were dismissed against Oliver North. And it was my contention that elements of the U.S. national security establishment aligned with both the Galen spy organization, the Nazi Eastern Front spy outfit we incorporated at the end of World War II, and the World Anti-Communist League, basically Galen Wackel-related elements of our national security establishment, deliberately perpetrated that bombing in order to force the, among other things, there were a lot of H's scratched, but to force the dismissal of conspiracy charges against Oliver North, and specifically covering up the Manzer El-Kassar connection, which basically, like other connections, would have revealed that Oliver North and his wing of the National Security Establishment, and it's important to note here that there are divisions within the U.S. National Security Establishment, well, basically his wing of it was deliberately working against the interests of the United States, and specifically a number of key CIA counterintelligence people who were involved, or basically intelligence operatives who were involved with counterterrorism, they died on the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. It was my contention that in addition to forcing the secreting of all documents pertaining to Manzer El-Kassar and his milieu, which then became very important because of their position vis-a-vis the investigation into the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103, their failure to disclose, the administration's failure to disclose those documents, could then be safely cloaked under the guise of national security, thereby protecting Manzer El-Kassar and that Oliver North connection, and keeping getting the conspiracy charges dismissed against Oliver North. In addition, it was my contention that a lot of people were intimidated by that particular bombing, and that in particular, a key number of CIA and State Department counterterror officials were eliminated in that bombing, and that this perhaps may have eliminated people with information relevant to the Iran-Contra scandal, and in particular, hostages still in Beirut. And there has been speculation that perhaps those hostages played a role in events later than the Iran-Contra scandal, and perhaps even the 1988 campaign. In any event, there was an article, which I have read into the archives, that in which Representative James Traficant of Ohio and later Representative Traficant and former CIA agent Victor Marchetti, the author of The CIA and the Cult of Intelligence, well, basically, they have released sections of a Pan Am insurance investigator's report which blames the bombing on Manzer El-Kassar. Basically, Manzer El-Kassar is the central name that I had mentioned in connection with the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. And again, that information is in the archives in an update to the December surprise that I will be playing in the future. However, a listener has obtained the 5 pages of the report from the Pan Am Insurance Investigators report blaming this on Manzer El-Kassar, and it reveals what I had suspected and what I predicted in the December surprise broadcast originally recorded in January 8th of this year, and also on the 15th, namely that one group in the CIA, and it's important to understand there are sharp divisions within the National Security Establishment, but that one group that had been investigating the hostage situation in Beirut, and it's all of the details here are not clear, because I only have 5 pages, the rest have not been released for public scrutiny. It's not clear all of the details, but this McKee group, as it's going to be referred to here, was investigating the hostage situation in Beirut. They were a special team, and they discovered, among other things, a CIA protection for Manzer El-Kassar and his drug and terrorist operations. And it's the CIA group aligned with Manzer El-Kassar, who actually helped place the bomb for Ahmed Jibril and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the group involved here, with, among others, a BKA agent or BND agent, it's not clear which, named Marwan Krisat. In the paper, it was reported as BND, which is the West German CIA, the final incarnation of the Gehlen organization. Here, it's reported as the BKA, the Bundeskriminalamt, the West German Federal Police. Now, the important thing is that, and I'm going to have to race through this pretty quickly here, I'm going to read all 5 of these damn pages right into the record right now, and the important thing is that, and there's some names here that I don't understand because the information is in the unreleased pages that are still classified, I guess you could say, but the important thing is that Manzer El-Kassar actually helped place the bomb, and that the CIA group running Manzer El-Kassar received information that the CIA group that was blown up on Pan Am Flight 103 had discovered their operation, and yet nothing was done. There's a sort of a Keystone Cops scenario presented here, which ultimately smacks more of conspiracy than bungling, but the point is here that this one CIA group, according to this report, knew that the other CIA group, the group that had information about the hostage situation, was going to be on the plane, and the operation went ahead as planned, and CIA control, as its CIA headquarters, blocked information that could have prevented this bombing. There also were some errors, but they basically, in a nutshell, this report confirms the basis of my December surprise hypothesis, that not only was Manzar El-Kassar central to the whole thing, according to this Pan Am insurance investigator's report, he actually helped place the bomb, but that indeed his CIA, the CIA group that was running him, and again, this is according to this report. I can't say this is absolute gospel, but again, it's from an official insurance investigator for Pan Am, and with the millions that are riding on the lawsuit facing Pan Am, you can bet they're going to try and wriggle through any safe hole in the fence they can, and that this is a pretty professional operation. Insurance investigators don't operate via horoscope. They're pretty hard and cut-and-dried individuals. But in any event, I'm going to read this into the record, and the most important thing is the Manzar El-Kassar connection and the fact that the CIA group protecting him knew that the other CIA group, the McKee group, which got blown up on Pan Am Flight 103, and which might, it appears here, probably did have a lot of information relevant to one aspect or another of the Iran-Contra scandal, that basically they went down with the knowledge of the other CIA group. Now, this information was obtained, as I said, research credit on this to a listener. This was obtained. This is a press release, November 6, 1989, RE Pan Am Flight 103, partial investigative report. And it's pages 15 through 19. Ali Recep, a Syrian living in Sofia, Bulgaria, reportedly arranged the bomb components and their shipment into West Germany in November 1988 via a route provided by El-Kassar. Note here the Bulgarian connection in the Stibom Arms for Drugs ring, which we talk about. Although it's a Western ring, there are elements of it that pass through Soviet bloc countries, notably, Bulgaria, with the knowledge and apparent good graces of elements of the Bulgarian National Security Establishment. The point here being that capital it tends to be more important than ideology in the final analysis. Although it's a Western control operation, it goes on with the good graces of elements of Soviet bloc intelligence, which again should lead us perhaps to avoid oversimplification in some of these matters. And at any rate, proceeding quickly, and I realize this is fast, I just opened this at the beginning of the broadcast, so this is improvised archival material here. Ali Recep, R-A-C-E-P, a Syrian living in Sofia, Bulgaria, telephone 922-3294, reportedly arranged the bomb components and their shipments into West Germany in November of 1988 via a route provided by El-Kassar. One reason this shipment may have been necessary was that in late October of 1988, a terrorist safe house in Neuss, N-E-U-S-S, West Germany, was raided by BKA/BND. That's the Marwan Krisat raid I spoke about in the update to December Surprise, in which the person who ultimately put the bomb together was released after having been busted by West German intelligence, thereby again strongly confirming the elements of my December surprise hypothesis. Continuing. Beginning again, one reason this shipment may have been necessary was that in late October of 1988, a terrorist safe house in Neuss, West Germany, was raided by BKA-BND. They were tipped by El-Kassar intermediaries who wanted to avoid terrorist operations near to and which could spoil his CIA-1 protected Frankfurt drug routes. They arrested 14 persons, including Dal Kamani, Gandanafar, and Marwan Krisat, and found numerous bombs and audio equipment. BKA bungled the job, though. First, they quickly released Krisat. He has since then been publicly identified as a double agent, i.e. a terrorist informing to BKA. However, he is now suspected of having been a triple working all along for the terrorists. Second, they did a sloppy job finding and then investigating the various devices. One BKA technician instructed to check, unquote, a radio, thought he was to fix it and opened it. It exploded, killing him. This Semtex bomb was similar to that used in the disaster. In any event, and this is an important part, in any event, El-Kassar actually brought the bomb in personally. His brother Ghassan's wife, Nabila Vebe, W-E-H-B-E, traveling on a South Yemen diplomatic passport, flew from Damascus to Sofia on November 13, 1988, picked up the bomb and components from Recep, and then flew to Paris. El-Kassar picked up the bomb from her, and on November 25, 1988, rented a car from Shafiq Rent-A-Car, 46 Rue Pierre Charon in Paris, and drove to Frankfurt, carrying other contraband as well. He had previously been arrested twice by West German border guards, but each time was suddenly released after a telephone call was made. Sources speculate that he apparently felt secure because he had protection. Well, again, El-Kassar stopped twice at the German border, released. As we will learn here, he was protected by CIA, or elements thereof, and that's important to note, because these elements apparently, well, so they certainly bear complicity in the death of other elements. As to the target, Jibril, that's again from the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, as to the target, Jibril preferred not to interfere with Al-Qassar's successful Pan Am route to avoid a clash with Duba, D-U-B-A, and neither did Duba since he had made money from the drugs and it's unclear who he is. He's described in the unreleased part. Jibril chose American Airlines as his target. It was at this time, approximately the beginning of December 1988, the tips and warnings filtered in. Our sources have identified the warnings as follows, turning the page. First, about 3 weeks, and a lot of this, before I begin, a lot of this is kind of abstruse. It's not the easiest language, and a lot of it isn't going to be clear here because, again, it's technical and it comes in the other pages. I'm just going to highlight the central parts and whip through it as fast as I reasonably can. First, about 3 weeks prior to the disaster, a Mossad agent in the position to personally observe tipped his headquarters that a major terror attack would take place at Frankfurt Airport against a U.S. airline. Mossad headquarters warned CIA headquarters and BKA headquarters. Thereafter, the law enforcement presence, but not airline security, visibly increased around the other American air carriers, but not Pan Am. Sources report that CIA-1 wanted to steer the warned-of act to a place where it could observe same best, Pan Am. CIA-1 suggested that BKA visibly secure the other American carriers and thus deter an attack there. Nidal and Al-Qassar, meanwhile, did not know Jibril's next plans. From their own spies, they now realized that he was planning a bomb attack at or via Frankfurt Airport. They did not have the political pull to dissuade him. Duba was caught between two conflicting forces. One is money from Al-Qassar's drugs, and two, his intelligence orders and pressure to help Jibril hit America. He chose the latter. Al-Qassar and Nidal assumed first that Jibril aimed at Lufthansa, but then thought it could be American or Pan Am. Their spies told them that it would happen in the next few days. This was on or a few days prior to December 18th of 1988. Second, Nidal and Al-Qassar then figured out the most likely flights for Jibril's bomb. They wanted to protect their route's CIA-1 cover. On or about December 18, 1988, via intermediaries, they tipped BKA that a bomb would be placed on this regular Pan Am Frankfurt London New York flight in the next 3 days. They figured that BKA would increase visible security, thus dissuading Jibril in case that was in fact his target. So 2 to 3 days before the disaster, and unwittingly, these terrorists tipped off the authorities to what proved to be the very act. One more time. So 2 to 3 days before the disaster, and unwittingly, these terrorists tipped off the authorities to what proved to be the very act. Third, CIA-1 reported to its control. Oh, BKA told CIA-1. That's important. CIA-1 knows about the act. Third, CIA-1 reported to its control, who reported to CIA headquarters, which sent warnings to various embassies, etc., but not, apparently, to Pan Am. CIA-1 thought that BKA surveillance would pick up the action and that BKA would stop the act in case the tip was correct. Very important part coming up here, the key to much of the December surprise hypothesis. Meanwhile, CIA-1 learned from Al-Qassar further information about the special McKee-led CIA team in Beirut. That's the group that went down on Pan Am Flight 103 investigating the hostage situation. One more time. Meanwhile, CIA-1 learned from Al-Qassar further information about the special McKee-led CIA team in Beirut. Al-Qassar had earlier, possibly within a month or so, reported to CIA-1 what to him was very disturbing news, which CIA-1 then had confirmed from its control. The earlier news was as follows. After some time, the special team, now the special team is the McKee team that went down on 103, after some time, the special team learned of Al-Qassar and started investigating him and learned his CIA-protected drug and arms smuggling and terrorism support activities. They also realized that some CIA unit was protecting his drug smuggling into the U.S. via Frankfurt Airport. One more time. The news that disturbed Al-Qassar and CIA-1. The earlier news was as follows. After some time, the special team learned of Al-Qassar and started investigating him and learned his CIA-protected drugs and arms smuggling and terrorism support activities, or learned of them, it should have said. They also realized that some CIA unit was protecting his drug smuggling into the U.S. via Frankfurt Airport. They also learned of a CIA drug smuggling operation for hostage help deal and that it was known and agreed by Syrian intelligence, which had a master plan to blame Iran if the deal was exposed. They had communicated back to Langley the facts and names and reported their film of the hostage locations. CIA did nothing. No reply. The team, that's the McKee team that went down on the plane, the team was outraged, believing that its rescue and their lives would be endangered by the double dealing. By mid-December, the team became frustrated and angry and made plans to return to the U.S. with their photos and evidence to inform the government and to publicize their findings if the government covered up. They did not seek permission to return, which is against the rules. The return was unannounced. The team was surveilled by Al-Qassar and probably Syrian agents when making its travel plans, which included connecting with Flight 103 in London on December 21, 1988. Sources report 8 CIA team members on that flight, but we have only identified the 5 names reported herein. Al-Qassar contacted his CIA-1 handler sometime in the third week of December 1988, communicated the latest news and travel information, and asked for help. There were numerous communications between CIA-1 and its control. Fourth, 2 to 3 days before the disaster, a BKA undercover agent reported to his superiors a plan to bomb a Pan Am flight in the next few days. BKA passed the intelligence to CIA-1. Again, CIA-1 wanted to warn its people, quote-unquote, but did not want to blow its surveillance operation and undercover penetration or to risk the Al-Qassar hostage release operation. Warnings were sent via the State Department to its embassies. These may be the same warnings as described above. Turning to page 18. CIA-1 and or its control apparently planned, control was distracted by the McKee's team planned return and events were moving quickly, as were decisions that BKA's surveillance would pick up the action at the airport and then come up with an anonymous tip, unquote, to plausibly explain why it was suddenly examining the checked luggage. We do not know what, if any, tips were given to the other American carriers, but law enforcement, not airline security, suddenly tightened even more around them, but not Pan Am. Jibril or his on-scene lieutenants then decided to scratch American Airlines and finally select Pan Am. We do not know exactly when this decision was made, but the dates point to 2 to 3 days before the flight. Sources speculate that, although Jibril knew this jeopardized Nidal and Al-Qassar's drug route, he felt that he was too committed to stop and had to go through with his plans, and in a bit of double-dealing, rationalized that any exposure of the act and blame would fall on his rival Nidal. Jibril, through an intermediary, activated the Jafar-Turkish baggage handler connection via Pan Am. For the Turk and Jafar, this was another normal drug run. It's not unclear here who these people are. Jafar does not profile as a suicidal martyr type. Fifth, an undercover Mossad agent tipped BKA within 24 hours before takeoff as to the plan to place a bomb on that very Pan Am flight. BKA passed that to CIA-1 and asked for instructions. CIA-1 so reported to its control. CIA-1 did not reply to BKA. The bomb was ready. Within 24 to 48 hours before the flight, a black Mercedes had parked in the airport lot, and the Turkish baggage handler picked up a suitcase from that auto and took it into the airport and placed it in the employee locker area. That was his usual practice with drugs. Turning the page. Sixth. On December 21st, 1988, a BKA surveillance agent watching that Pan Am flight's loading noticed that the drug, unquote, suitcase substituted was different in make, shape, material, and color from that used for all previous drug shipments. This one was a brown Samsonite case. He, like the other BKA agents on the scene, had been extra alert due to all the bomb tips. Within an hour or so before takeoff, he phoned in a report as to what he had seen, saying something was very wrong. Boy, is that an understatement. BKA, that's my interjection, of course. I'm not trying to be cute. BKA passed that information to CIA-1. It reported to its control. Control replied, "Don't worry about it. Don't stop it. Let it go." CIA-1 issued no instructions to BKA. BKA did nothing. The BKA was then covertly videotaping that area on that day. A videotape was made. It shows the perpetrator in the act. It was held by BKA. A copy was made and given to CIA-1. The BKA tape has been lost, quote-unquote. However, the copy exists at CIA-1 control in the U.S. Jafar boarded the flight after checking one piece of luggage. The suitcase first emerged from hiding and it was placed on the luggage cart in substitution for Jafar's only after all the checked suitcases had already passed through security. The suitcase was so switched by the Turkish Pan Am baggage loader. The method bypassed all airline security measures in place. The only measure for airlines to defeat this method would be for security guards to personally conduct all luggage under their personal view from start to actual loading, and then closing of the baggage cargo holds on the plane. Only El Al does this. The special designated communications code name, which BKA CIA 1 had set up for their operations as described above, is known at CIA headquarters as Korea, spelled capital C-O, capital C, capital O, capital R, capital E, capital A. All communications concerning the surveillance operation and as described above, as between or among BKA CIA 1 and CIA 1 control, were made via Korea. Thus, all documents concerning all communications described above ought be marked at the top Korea, ought to be marked at the top Korea, should have read. This completes the recitation of intelligence as to the act. This will be added into the archives as a supplement to yet another supplement to the December surprise broadcast, which is now Radio Free America 35. Again, I realize that a lot of that is perhaps not immediately clear. Let me go back then and reread the San Jose Mercury News article from which I read, that I read into the archives some time ago. This may help straighten some of that out. This is from the San Jose Mercury News of Saturday, November 4th of 1989. It's a Mercury News story, Dateline Washington headline, "Lawmaker links arms dealer to bombing of Pan Am jet." It's by Frank Grieve and Aaron Epstein of the Mercury News Washington Bureau. It reads in part as follows. A Syrian weapons and drug dealer used by White House aide Oliver North to secretly arm Nicaraguan rebels has been linked to the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103, which exploded over Lockerbie, Scotland last year, an Ohio congressman charged Friday. The arms merchant, Manzer El-Kassar, also served in the United States as a go-between in negotiations on the release of U.S. hostages held by Iranian-controlled radicals in Beirut, said Democratic Representative James Traficant. According to Traficant, the CIA made a deal with Al-Kassar to overlook his drug dealing in return for his help in freeing the hostages. As a result, Traficant said, the CIA ignored warnings of a plot to bomb Flight 103 by a terrorist group allegedly supplied by Al-Kassar. The New York-bound Pan Am 747 departed from London, then exploded over Lockerbie, Scotland on December 21, 1988, killing all 259 people aboard and 11 on the ground. The flight and apparently the baggage containing the bomb originated in Frankfurt, Germany, aboard a Boeing 727. Traficant said his allegations were based on an investigator's report to Pan Am's insurance underwriters. The airline is defending itself against a $300 million suit filed by families of crash victims. Pan Am lawyers are seeking to prove that U.S. government agencies ignored warnings from West German and Israeli authorities. The congressman, reading excerpts from the report, said that the CIA may have known that a bomb had been loaded aboard Flight 103 in Frankfurt, but did nothing about it. That appears to be something of an understatement here. According to Traficant, CIA agents in Frankfurt operating under the codename Korea were protecting Al-Kassar's heroin shipments to the United States in exchange for his help in freeing U.S. hostages. West German police, monitoring drug traffic by videotaping Pan Am baggage operations in Frankfurt, informed the CIA agents that a piece of brown Samsonite luggage had been substituted for a courier bag containing an narcotics shipment, Traficant said. The CIA agents passed the information on to CIA control, which advised the agents to, quote, let it go, the congressman said. Subpoenas filed in federal court here by Pan Am lawyers demand that the CIA and other U.S. agencies turn over all documents about pre-crash warnings Al-Kassar, Korea, and drug trafficking at the airport in Frankfurt. Skipping down, Al-Kassar, now 45, believed to be living in Austria, is a notorious figure in the world of international arms dealing. Al-Kassar played a more useful role as an intermediary in the 1986 release of two French hostages held by Iranian-controlled Lebanese Shiites, according to the French magazine Libération. The office of then-Premier Jacques Chirac denied the report. A U.S. government counterterrorist team was assigned to develop a similar relationship with Al-Kassar, Traficant said. Al-Kassar received $1.5 million in 1986 from a Swiss company controlled by Los Gatos businessman Albert Hakim and retired Air Force Major General Richard Secord, according to a ledger kept by Hakim and made public during the 1987 Iran-Contra hearings. In return, Al-Kassar provided more than 100 tons of Eastern Bloc small arms to a shipment intended for the Contras. Well, that's the Iria deal, and among the documents that North's defense team wanted were documents pertaining to the Iria deal. Now, Traficant makes no deal of the fact that, he doesn't mention that the McKee team had come on to the CIA-1 Al-Kassar team, and that basically they were aware of that relationship, and that basically no action was taken, and they were allowed to go down. This jibes precisely with my December surprise hypothesis. Again, turning to page 17 of the report. Meanwhile, CIA-1 learned from Al-Kassar further information about the special McKee-led CIA team in Beirut. Al-Kassar had earlier, possibly within a month or so, reported to CIA-1 what to him was very disturbing news, which CIA-1 had then confirmed from its control. The earlier news was as follows. After some time, the special team learned of Alcazar and started investigating him and learned his CIA-supported drugs and arms smuggling and terrorism support, learned of his CIA-supported drugs and arms smuggling and terrorism support activities. They also realized that some CIA unit was protecting his drug smuggling into the U.S. via Frankfurt Airport. They also learned of a CIA drug smuggling protection for hostage help deal that it was known, and that it was known and agreed by Syrian intelligence, which had a master plan to blame Iran if the deal was exposed. They had communicated back to Langley the facts and names and reported their film of the hostage locations. CIA did nothing. No reply. The team was outraged, believing that its rescue and their lives would be endangered by the double dealing. By mid-December, the team became frustrated and angry and made plans to return to the U.S. with their photos and evidence to inform the government and to publicize their findings if the government covered up. They did not seek permission to return, which is against the rules. The return was unannounced. The team was surveilled by Alcazar and probably Syrian agents when making its travel plans, which included connecting with Flight 103 in London on December 21st, 1988. Sources report that eight CIA team members on that flight, but we have only identified the five names reported herein. Alcazar contacted his CIA-1 handler sometime in the third week of December 1988, communicated the latest news and travel information, and asked for help. There were numerous communications between CIA-1 and its control. Well, it looks like the December surprise was a surprise, but it's not turning out to be such a surprise in these quarters. That is basically what I had said. And again, this will go into the archives as an additional archive show. Well, very briefly, I'm going to read a very important piece of information. This will be stuck back into the archives. But I have now obtained more of the Pan Am 103 Insurance Investigators report. This comes courtesy of the Los Angeles office of the Christic Institute. And interestingly enough, as I suspected, the source for this information, although obviously they're not named by name, but they're all very reliable, and if anything, they're going to err on the side of conservatism, because obviously this is from Western intelligence sources. On pages 5 and 6 of the Pan Am 103 Insurance Investigators report, we find the following. Our sources are, by the way, this was written by a former Mossad agent who was the investigator. Our sources are and must remain confidential. However, before starting our findings, and in order to provide you some basics for estimating their accuracy, it is useful to first classify our sources generically and to rate them as to their respective reliability. We rate them not as to their organization's capabilities for general intelligence, but as to intelligence concerning terrorism. Sources. Source 1 is comprised of 6 persons working in different units of the intelligence community of a Western government. Reliability of this information is very good. Generally, this group of agencies is only fair to good among the various persons reporting based on our prior experience and its past record. However, the very number of separate sources in these agencies, not necessarily sympathetic to each other, all sharing the conclusion as well as the depth of the intelligence gathered, and the agency's considerable resources and special interest in the matter justifies rating this information as very good. Source 2 is comprised of 3 persons working in different units of the intelligence agency of a second Western government. Reliability of this information is very good, not so much due to prior experience with the source, which is good to very good, but because of their position to know the particular facts. Source 3 is 1 person working for the intelligence agency of a third Western-oriented government. Reliability of this information is excellent based on our prior experience with both the agency and the particular person, its and his prior record, and its position to know firsthand these matters. Source 4 is 1 person working for the intelligence agency of a fourth Western government. Good. It is normally rated very good, but is conservatively downgraded as to this matter because its information seems in some aspects to be derivative, i.e., in great part based on information received from other agencies. It must be emphasized that these sources did not have as their objective the acquisition of evidence for the apprehension and trial of the perpetrators. Rather, their objective is to monitor terrorist acts, draw conclusions based on their expertise, and then use what they learn so as to defend their countries in the future. Source 5 is an experienced director of airport security for the most security-conscious airline. He was in a position to receive the inside consensus of various security officers at Frankfurt Airport, which he reported to us. That concludes the prepared portion of this broadcast.